You are listening to the podcast of Providence Church in Austin, Texas. We hope this message raises your affections for Jesus and helps you live out the gospel in everyday life.
We are taking some time this fall to talk about encountering Jesus, to have personal and experiential knowledge of him. If you watch cable channels, about every year, you know, there's some special that's usually like the real Jesus, the historical Jesus, something of that nature. And the whole show is usually just a series of interviews with guys like in old dress shirts with lots of books behind them talking about who Jesus is. There's never just some dude in a t-shirt going, I don't know, I was blind and now I can see. Right? There's never a businesswoman saying, well, here's the deal. I pray for very specific things and then they happen. Right? There's never someone who's going, you know, I was unbelievably selfish. I was so harsh with people, preoccupied with my own life, and I don't know what happened, but God in his mercy has made me gentle and generous. It's crazy. It's never any of that. It's always the suits talking about Jesus from afar. But what we're talking about encountering Jesus, we're talking about the latter group of people. We're talking about people who have been up close and personal with him. Now, I don't mean to say that objective truth is one thing and subjective experience is another, and these are at odds with each other. Not at all. Absolutely need both. We need objective truth about who God is, but then we need that truth made real to us personally in our everyday lives. That's what we're talking about. And when you read through the stories about Jesus' life, it happens all the time. People have these kinds of encounters with him. All kinds of people come to him, from all classes and all statuses of life, looking for help and insight and healing and power, just anything. And he gives it to them. Faith for people, as you read it in the Gospels, was real simple. It wasn't as complicated as we make it. In Jesus' day, when people came to him, their faith was simply a confidence in him and what he could do. And so in this series, our aim is to sort of get in these people's shoes, to come before Jesus like they did. Not pretending, not performing, but just with simple faith. A confidence in who he is and what he can do. A desperate longing just to get in his presence. And then an eagerness to just see what he does. That's firsthand knowledge. 2 weeks ago, I told a story about a man who was miraculously healed. He had lost his voice and he was teaching a Sunday school class, and while he was reading through Psalm 103, when he said, "The Lord redeems my life from the pit," his voice came back. And some of you went and listened to that audio, and you could hear it for yourselves, and it's really powerful. It's an amazing story. When he was healed, he didn't know what to do. He was obviously overcome with emotion, and so he just read the rest of Psalm 103. And that's how I ended the sermon. I just read most of Psalm 103. Thought nothing of it. I said, well, that would be a good way to end the thing. I never know how to end these things. That'd be easy. During communion, a guy in our church came up to me to take communion, and he did not look well. He looked like he was hurting, and I said, are you okay, man? And he said, let's talk after church. I said, okay. So he takes communion, and after church, he grabs me, and we sit down in one of the pews, and I said, are you okay? And he said, I need to tell you something. I said, okay. He said, for so long, I've wanted God to be real, and it's finally happening. And I was like, okay, good. Not a crisis. This is a good thing. And I said, well, what's happening? And he goes, so much, too much. I can't tell you all of it, and I don't know where to start, but let me just try this and see if this means anything to you. And then he says, bless the Lord, O my soul. And he quotes all the way through Psalm 103, through tears, slowly. Like you could tell that every word had oceans of meaning for this guy, and he was crying oceans of tears as he said these words all the way through. I just sat there and listened in amazement. He gets through and he says, Will, I don't know. I've been reading this chapter every day for months, and I don't know why. And then today. And I didn't have any words, which is like its own sub-miracle plot in this story. And I just sat there, and he said, well, here's the twist. He said, Will, I got mugged last night. Okay, we're switching subjects now. I was like, what? He goes, I got mugged last night. I'm standing in front of my house. A guy steps out, puts a gun to my face. And now the tears start coming again. These are different kind of tears. These aren't tears of celebration. These are tears of humiliation and pain. He says, he put a gun to my face. He took all my things and he beat me up. And then he says, but I don't care. Because when God's real, it doesn't matter. Now listen, he's not saying getting mugged is no big deal. Getting mugged is a big deal. It's awful. What he's saying is, in comparison to having God real to me, getting mugged is not as big a deal. In that moment, he had a deep-seated confidence that God was real, and it gave him what Paul calls a peace that surpasses all understanding. This week, I followed up with him because he got mugged, and I wanted to make sure he was okay. I let him come down off that high a little bit. I was like, all right, are you okay? He goes, oh my gosh, I've never been better. He was still there. And I got more of the story, and at one point he said about that experience, he goes, I was never sure. I've never been more sure of God's presence with me than in that moment when I was getting mugged. Now, these stories kind of mess with me a little bit. They produce some tension in me because I want assurance. I want joy and peace. I don't want to get mugged, though. Can I get it without getting mugged? Look, nowhere in the scripture does it say that we should go looking for trials. But what it does say is that trials will find you on their own. And the story that we're looking at today is an illustration of that. We're really going to look at the second half of what was read. But in this story, these little four verses, the disciples are overtaken by a great storm. And it becomes an opportunity for them to encounter Christ. And so if you've been in church for a long time, you've been a Christian for a while, this is a little heads up to you. The disciples need saving too. And they're going to get it today. When storms of life come our way, we usually kind of handle them in one of two ways. We either just despair and give up. It overwhelms. Or we try to get control of that sucker. We get in charge. We get busy. Those are really two sides of the same coin. The root underneath both of them is a lack of faith or a misplaced confidence. The question in this story is not, will there be storms? The question is what will you do in the storms? That's what this is about. And it unfolds in four parts, four short parts. A great storm, a great panic, a great calm, and then a great question. I'm going to move through those fairly quickly. Here's the first one, a great storm. Look at verse 24 in Matthew 8. And behold, there arose a great storm on the sea, so that the boat was being swamped by the waves, but he was asleep. All right, this is our setting. We got a great storm. They're on the Sea of Galilee, which is famous for great storms. It's a relatively small lake. It's not very deep, about 200 feet at its deepest point. It's about 600 feet below sea level, but the hills all around it are up to 2,000 feet, and so the cool air from the mountains comes rushing down into the warm air of the basin of the lake, and it just kicks up this little lake, and crazy storms can happen. In the early 90s, there was a storm on the Sea of Galilee that sent 10-foot waves into downtown Tiberias and just caused significant damage. I think that the disciples are in a storm like that one. And it wouldn't be totally foreign to them. Some of them, anyway, are fishermen. They grew up on this very lake. They'd seen storms before. But not like this one. This was a storm they just couldn't navigate. They are bailing the water out, but they can't bail it out fast enough. They're going to sink, and they know it. Meanwhile, Jesus is with them, but he's asleep. And he's really asleep. He's not just like pretending to teach them a lesson. Jesus, the man of Nazareth, if you read the chapter, he had a long day. It was exhausting. And he is out. And the disciples must have been thinking, well, what good is it to have God with you if he's sleeping? What do we do here? And they're overwhelmed. They're sure they're going to die. They're in a great storm. The first thing to, I think, say about this is that it really happened to them. This is one of the compelling things about the Bible is the people who wrote it don't change the story to make themselves look better. There's no spin. There's no polish. They just let their failures out there for the world to read. This is why you get a lot of details that don't seem to even be necessary sometimes in the scriptures. They're everywhere. In this story, if you look at Mark and Luke's account, you see that Jesus is not just sleeping, he's asleep in the stern on a cushion. Why? Why do we need to know that? But that's the point. The point is they're just telling the story as they remember it. This isn't the stuff of legend or of fairy tale. This is the stuff of eyewitness reporting. It really happened. And that's important for us because if we're to encounter Jesus in our storms, then we need to know that they really did encounter him in their storms. And those are kind of the two layers that Matthew is trying to convey here. This storm really happened to them. But it is also a living parable of what happens with all of us. We will go through storms. In John 16, Jesus warned them of this. He said, look, in this world where you're staying, I'm leaving, but you're staying, and in this world, you'll have trouble. Take heart, I've overcome the world. Peter later confirms this, and he tells the people he's writing to, he says, hey, don't be surprised when trials come upon you, as if some strange thing was happening. Right? They're warning us, they're assuring us, you are going to go through storms. And the imagery of a great storm itself, is dreadful. The image I've had in my mind all week is that family that was vacationing in Wimberley last year when those floods came, and the river rose and it swept the house out from its stilts, and they're in the house floating down the raging river. And they were absolutely helpless, absolutely overwhelmed, trapped, nothing to do. That's what a storm is in your life. It's a situation where you feel trapped, overwhelmed, helpless, out of control. And some of you feel that way right now. It's kind of cool that it's storming outside right now. Just FYI. The thing about this church that is a little dangerous is that you come in here and it's like, man, this is a really great looking group of people. Everybody's smart and talented and everybody's starting a business. Nobody's making any money, by the way, but everybody's starting a business. That's really cool. But that's a dangerous dynamic, right? Because individually, you all know that you don't have it together. But if it feels like everybody else does, man, that is really isolating. And the last thing you need in a storm is to feel like you're alone. So let's get it out there. Nobody in here has it together. Not even close. I've walked with some people through some pretty difficult storms. In this community, there's always a storm brewing. Physical sickness, like even debilitating, life-threatening kinds of sickness. Psychological disorder. Anxiety, depression, just to name a couple. Marriages that are holding on, I mean, by a thin thread. People dealing with past abuses in their life. People wrestling with all kinds of addiction, with loneliness, with financial distress, unresolved conflict, the kind that keeps you up at night. Those are just some of the storms that I know of right now, like in the room currently. There's always something going on in this community. Storms are inevitable. And some of you feel like God is asleep. You're asking that question, why isn't God doing anything already? We all ask that question. And so let me say this. Jesus is asleep in the boat, but he's not unaware of the storm. He deliberately takes the disciples into the storm. He lets the boat start to sink before he does anything. And so the question isn't, is God aware? The question is why is he so slow to help them? Here's just a couple observations I had. One reason is that God can be with us and not be doing what we think he should be doing. That is sort of the definition of what it means that he's God. Is that he gets to do what he wants and it doesn't have to be what we want or think is right. And secondly, I just think People often encounter Jesus when they come to the end of themselves. You know, they don't go first to Jesus. They start bailing water because they know what to do. They're fishermen. It's when that doesn't work anymore, that's when they go. And so we're going to see that the disciples do encounter Jesus. But first, they're in a great panic. Verse 25. They went and woke him up, saying, "Save us, Lord. We're perishing." In Luke and Mark's version, they say, "Don't you care?" They're convinced they're going to die, and they're in a great panic. Panic is that sense that you've lost control, that there's nothing left that you can do. And I think there is a fundamental panic deep down in every one of our souls. I think deep down we all have this underlying question of panic, which is, have I done enough? Or can I do enough? Can I get enough success that people will respect me, that they'll see me? Can I get enough money that I'll be secure? Can I do enough for my kids to ensure that they're going to be okay? Can I do enough to somehow make someone marry me or want to stay married to me? Can I buy enough stuff? Can I go enough places? Can I have enough experiences to feel like I am really winning at life? Deep down, there's this low-level panic that's always wondering, am I good enough, and am I going to do enough? We try to push it down, but it's just always there. When storms come into our lives, they bring the panic to the surface. Because storms remind us that we're not in control. They remind us that we are helpless. We can't save ourselves. And storms force us to go to Jesus and say, "Save us!" That's what they finally do. They go to Jesus. Now, look how he responds to them. Verse 26. They say, "Save us, Lord, we're perishing." And he said to them, "Why are you afraid, you of little faith?" It makes total sense to me why they're afraid, but Jesus questions them. Why are you afraid? You have little faith. And the word at the end there is really just one word. It's like if you were to translate it, it would just be called little faith. It's like he's calling them a name. You know, it's like when somebody in our time does something, backs down from something or is weak, we might say, "Dude, that is weak sauce, man." That's kind of what he's saying. He's like, "Guys, you guys are little faith. This is weak sauce. Why are you afraid?" Now look at the connection. He seems to be saying, if you had faith, you wouldn't be afraid. He is not saying, if you had faith, then you wouldn't be in this storm. He's the one that brought him into the storm. He is saying, if you had faith, you wouldn't be afraid in the midst of this storm. Now, why does he say that? Because they had faith. They've left everything to follow him. They believe in Jesus. But I want you to remember that faith is not simply a static, one-time thing. Faith is this dynamic thing in our lives. We can be very courageous in faith, and we can be weak sauce in faith. And we can kind of go in and out of those things. And so Jesus is saying, hey, right now, where is your faith? Why aren't you using it right now? So what does that mean to use your faith? Well, here's what I think faith is, practically, which is what it is. I think it is applying what we know about God, who he is and how he works and what he says. It's not mystical as much as it is practical, I think. And here's what I mean by that. You take what you know about God and you act on it. Not because the action itself is the pleasing thing, but you act on it in faith that if you do this, if you obey, if you move this direction that he's leading you, then he will show up and he will prove to be who he says he is and he will do the very things that he says he can do. That's faith. Simply put, on mornings when I think God needs me to get up, wants me to get up early because there's stuff to do, God never needs me to get up, but when he wants me to, here's what faith looks like because I don't like getting up. I literally put a foot on the floor and I say, "God, I'm going to put the other foot down, and when I do, you're going to have to like get this thing going. You're going to have to give energy because I'll just go lay down on the floor and go to sleep again." Right? That sounds silly, doesn't it? Well, maybe that's just where I am in my life, but that's faith. Are you anxious about life? Well, here's what Jesus says. Jesus says, look, everybody's anxious. Everybody's worrying. Don't do that. You have a Father in heaven who knows what you need. And so seek his righteousness. Seek his kingdom. That is, stop preoccupying yourself with your little things and get out and follow him and see if he doesn't just take care of that stuff. See, it's not the faith that's powerful. It's God who's powerful. So act on him. Bank your life on him and see what he does. Are you feeling out of sorts with someone? Well, Jesus says, yeah, that happens. And if you feel that, especially at church, you should go to that person, be reconciled, do what you can, and then come back and worship and see if that doesn't change your worship experience. You know, but you're thinking, no, it's too complicated. It's more complicated than that, and they did this, and this. Well, is God who he says he is? Does he reconcile Jews and Gentiles into one body? So act on it and see what he does. Do you want to meet a need for someone? Well, Jesus says, give to the needy. Well, yeah, but I need that money. Well, Jesus says, give to the needy. And do it in secret. Don't even let anybody know about it, because you have a God who sees what you do in secret and who will reward you in secret. So sacrificially give to meet the needs of people around you and see if God doesn't, in his way, provide for you. Are you feeling like you want to read the Bible, but my goodness, how do I begin to understand that? I get that. Jesus said, when the Spirit comes, he will guide you. He will lead you into all the truth. And so let's start reading the Bible, admitting I don't know what's going on here, and see if the Holy Spirit doesn't teach you. Now listen, none of that happens like the first time or instantly or quickly. A lot of it happens over time, and so you got to keep exercising, keep growing in your faith and see what God does. The power's not faith. God's the power. Faith is the means by which he demonstrates his power in our lives. All right, let's get a little recap here. Jesus says, why are you so afraid? They say, duh, because we're dying. If you cared, if you loved us, you would have done something. And Jesus says, oh, okay, I see. You have the wrong assumption. You're at the wrong starting point. You think that if I love you, you wouldn't go through the storm. That's not true. Here's what's actually true. I let people I love go through storms. And I'm with them in the storm. If you knew that I loved you, if you knew that I cared, you could be calm on the inside, regardless of the chaos that's going on around you. Tim Keller says, the storm has power. Jesus has power. What's the difference? The storm doesn't love you. That's the gospel, right? The gospel answers the panic question. God sends his son into the world to say, you haven't done enough. You can't do enough. But I have done it. I've done it all. It's finished, and you can relax now. Come to me and rest in me. Even a little faith goes a long way if it's in the right person. And that's what we see with the disciples. Look at the rest of verse 26. They come to him. They're in a great panic. And look what he does, because he loves them. Then he arose and rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was a great calm. Isn't that what you want when you're in a great storm? Just a great calm. You want things to like settle down. And Jesus just graciously gives them that. He tells the wind and the sea, there's two verbs here, and the verbs are be quiet, stay quiet. And then there's a great calm. And this is the miraculous part. He could have said to the wind, stop, be quiet. And the wind could have stopped and you could have gone, maybe a coincidence. But then he says to the sea, also, be quiet and stay quiet, and the waters calm immediately. And if you've seen a storm on a lake, you know that even when the storm passes, the waters are still all choppy. It takes sometimes days for waters to calm, but he says, be quiet, stay quiet, and then it's like we're going water skiing. It's dead calm. It's incomparable power, but miracles are never the ultimate thing when you read the stories of Jesus' life. They're wonderful gifts from God. I'll take a calm storm any day. But it's not the ultimate thing. Miracles always point to some greater reality. Jesus heals sick people to say, I can heal your greater sickness. Jesus raises people from the dead to say, look, death's not the final word. He casts out demons to say that darkness has not and will not overcome the light. The miracles are real, but they point to greater realities. So what does this miracle say? What's it pointing to? I think Jesus calms the storm to say, I can do more than this. I can calm your heart. You can have peace with God. You can be getting mugged and never be more sure of my presence in your life. That's what he's saying to them. If you have faith, if you know who I am and what I can do, then you know that nothing can really sink you. There's no need to panic. I'm with you. I'm the Lord of the storm. I have watched a lot of people go through some really difficult storms. And I was thinking of stories I could share with you. And I decided to do one better than that, just to have one of my friends share their story with you. And so I'm going to invite Amanda McKinley up, who I've asked to just write and read her story for us so that we can enter in with her.
Sorry, I'm going to have to use my notes. My storm came while I was in the throes of what is normally an exhausting season for anyone. That season of parenting little ones, a time when you were going on little sleep and just trying to take care of the basic needs of your family. I think I struggled with depression before. I can see that now. It usually came on during seasons of change, like after graduating from college or post-honeymoon or postpartum. But those were nothing like this. This was a different kind of low. A low that felt like I was falling, like I had no control, and stranger yet, there was a part of me that wanted to fall and not try to fight it. I just felt so tired, so done with doing life as I had been doing it. It felt easier to let the darkness win, to let it envelop me in its soft, heavy weight. My first panic attack occurred at my children's preschool. It was something about the floor. The design in the carpet suddenly became this swirling beast that was jumping out at me. Of course, I knew this was not logical and chalked it up to lack of sleep. So I pressed on and continued down the hall to pick up my kids. On my way out, I collapsed. All I remember is being half carried out on my friend's shoulders and the shoulders of another teacher into the lobby. I didn't know what was happening. The only thing I remember is that my arms felt like they were on fire, painfully so. In the parking lot, my friends prayed for me and then called my husband, who took me to the emergency room. In the weeks and months following, I experienced waves of intense panic attacks multiple times a day. After each one, it felt like my body had run a marathon. I would sleep for hours afterwards, totally spent. I started going to bed around 7 p.m. every night and sometimes sleeping until noon the next day. Of course, my husband was worried. We knew this was not a schedule we could keep running on. One of the first people he called was Will Walker, who quickly began reaching out to his network of doctors, counselors, and therapists. Just so you know, we have some wonderful resources within the church. At first, my husband and I assumed this phase would pass, but when weeks turned to months, we knew we had to adjust to this new normal. I didn't feel normal. I felt like I was going crazy, and that fear just made things worse. For the next 3 years, I saw a slew of therapists and doctors who helped me understand what was happening and how to regulate my body when the attacks came on. I could barely drive my kids to school. The sun felt too bright. The buses were too loud. The bumps in the road were too jolting. Lawnmowers and blowers made me jump. I was ashamed, embarrassed, and intensely critical of myself. I would constantly be thinking, what is wrong with you? Get your stuff together. You're a mom. You need to function for your family. You have so much to be grateful for. Stop wallowing. Of course, none of that helped. It was frightening and humiliating and exhausting all at once. But oh, how gracious God was in the midst of this storm. Whew. Rarely has he given me a tangible dose of his presence in dark times. But I think he knew I needed something to hold on to. I'm a dreamer. Literally, I dream in vivid colors and scenes, which often inspires my writing. So, oh, how tender and compassionate was it that the Lord gave me visual images of hope that I could hang on to. It was often when I was curled up in a ball in the closet that these images came to mind. One, a hurricane. Fierce winds battered my body, trying to rip me away into utter darkness, but I was holding on to something, a wooden post, just a simple wooden post, as the storm whirled around me. As long as I held on to that post, I felt safe. It was my anchor. I believe that was Jesus. His tangible presence saying, I've got you. Cling to me. You don't have to be afraid. I am right here. The second image he gave me was a knotted rope hanging down from the sky, not a stormy sky, but a bright blue sky, dotted with wispy white clouds, and a voice soft and tender saying, hold on, just reach out and hold on, this will pass. But then I remember thinking, what if I can't hold on? What if I let go? And in response, he gave me a vision of an enormous hand, palm facing up, hovering just below the rope, ready to catch me if I fell. And a voice said, I am right here. I've got you. Trust me in this. I clung to those images every time I had a panic attack over the next 3 years. I would repeat his promises every time a fearful wave washed over me. And to me, that act of holding on to the wooden post or grabbing the rope that hung from the sky didn't mean that I should just muster up the strength to hold on, because I physically had none. I felt like a weak and wounded animal. No, the action was in my faith. A faith to bear the storm and wait for it to pass. A faith to grab the rope even when I didn't think I could. It was a faith in God, in his presence, his protection, his provision, and his mercy, even in the midst of the darkest storm. And like all storms, this one eventually passed. Today, I am able to function again for my family. And for that, I'm deeply grateful. But I will say, I have not experienced a tangible dose of his presence like that ever since. It was a sweet and precious gift he knew I needed in that moment. Not for every day, but for that particular storm. Psalm 28:7 says, the Lord is my strength and my shield. In him my heart trusts, and I am helped. Thank you.
They never clap for me. Thank you so much for sharing that. It's a vulnerable thing to relive a story, you know, in front of 300 people. Some of you, as you hear that story, you're thinking, yeah, I'm right there, or I'm somewhere in that neighborhood. And so just want to say to you, Amanda is willing to come alongside you. We have so many wonderful people in our church. After our service today, I'm going to have our deacons and maybe some of our small group leaders be up here on the front pews if you just feel like you want some help going to Jesus. And that really is the thing. The thing about encountering Jesus isn't what we get from the encounter. It's who we get. We get Jesus. And if you have his presence, you've got everything. You may be on a boat in a storm. You may be getting mugged in front of your house. You may be in a fetal position in your closet. But if you have Jesus, you've got everything. He's with you. He's for you. All of this leads us to consider what it means to have faith in Jesus. So we've looked at the great storm, the great panic, the external calm that points to an internal calm that he can bring. And it just makes you ask the question, what does it mean to have faith in him? Does it mean we have a wise guide? Does it mean we have somebody to talk to when we're hurting? Does it mean we have a ticket to heaven when we die? If faith is confidence in a person and what he can do, then we're asking the question, what sort of person is this? And that's the question the disciples ask. That's the question. Maybe that's why Jesus has brought them through this storm, so that they could come to that question. Not the question, how do I get things to settle down in my life, but the question, what sort of man is this? Look at verse 28-27. After he calmed the storm, the men marveled, saying, what sort of man is this that even the winds and the sea obey him? In Jewish thought, power over the sea was God's prerogative alone. He was the only one that could fathom having dominion or authority or power over the sea. And now here's Jesus having authority and power over the sea. What sort of man is this? In Matthew 12, Jesus says, something greater than Jonah is here. He's answering the question for us. He's saying, what kind of man am I? Well, I'm the greater Jonah, which is relevant to this text because there are so many parallels between this little story and the story of Jonah, and I'm confident that Matthew is doing that on purpose. If you're familiar with Jonah's story, maybe they can come to mind. You realize that in both stories, Jonah and Jesus, both of them are in a boat. They're both overtaken by a storm. They're both asleep when the storm comes. They're both awakened by people who say they're dying. And in both cases, a miracle occurs and the sea is calmed. Now, in Jonah's story, Jonah says, this is all my fault. I'm running from God. This is the reason the storm has come upon us. And he says, throw me over, because if I die, you guys will live. Now, the story in Matthew is not Jesus' fault, technically. I mean, I guess he led them into it. Whereas Jonah bears the punishment for his own sin, Jesus doesn't have the sin, but he did come to bear the punishment for those of us who have been running from God. Jesus, in effect, says, throw me over. If I die, you live. Storms are inevitable, but don't panic. Look to Jesus. See that he has gone through the ultimate, the greater storm, so that we could have peace with God. See him. See him slumped over. Not in the boat, but on the cross. See him in that ultimate storm where the sky goes black for 3 hours, where he cries out, my God, why are you sleeping? Why have you forsaken me? What are you doing? And see how God lets the storm come and swallow up his son. Just as Jonah was in the belly of the well for 3 days, after 3 days in the grave, the father rebukes death and says to his beloved son, get up, stay up. And now the son stands with us and says, you're going to have trouble, people, but take heart. I have overcome the world. Let's pray.
Thanks for listening to the podcast of Providence Church. For more resources and info, visit us online at www.providenceaustin.com.